Fortunately enough, there's a little red light that flashes on the front when it's at the end of the tape.
So. Great. Well, you have a signal then. Are you picking it up? Can you
tell? Yes. Everything's fine.
Good. Is this volume of speaking about right?
It's excellent.
Good. Okay, so to get on with the educational background, I went through the public schools in Port Arthur and did pretty well grade-wise, and I participated in all the activities except sports. I was never inclined to, well, I was never smart enough or able enough to play anything very well. I was a member of the debate team and did a good deal of public speaking and in school. And Latin contests and that sort of thing, mostly scholastic. Went to the University of Texas in 19...
Was that preordained that you would go there with both of your
parents? Oh, yes. There was no other place to go. I mean, you went to the university. The university with a capital T. And that was all there was to that. So, and I went to the university in 1933, chemical engineering, and got along pretty well there. And enjoyed that period very much indeed. And was fortunate enough at my senior year to be awarded a Tau Beta Pi Fellowship, which let me go wherever I wanted to go. And, of course, I wanted to go to MIT. So that got me started on the road to MIT. It didn't pay all that much. It didn't pay at all. But the fact that I was able to qualify for it and able to make the grade as far as getting into MIT is concerned was a big boost to my morale. So I was glad to have that chance to.
Tell me something about the chemical engineering department at UT. Your father had gone there as a chemistry major, is that correct?
That's right.
And I assume you were taking a lot of chemistry at the same time. What was the chemical engineering department like?
Embryonic. The nearest thing to a chemical engineering professor of standing that the department enjoyed at the time was Dr. E.P. Schoch, S-C-H-O-C-H, who was a pretty well-known physical chemist in his own right. And he taught physical chemistry, and that's what I took from him. And what my dad had taken from him, he was a great admirer of Dr. Schoch in his younger days and was close to him personally over the years. As a matter of fact, Dad at the time was chairman of the school board when I graduated, and he invited Dr. Schoch to come down and give the commencement address to our high school class. His chemical engineering interest, however, was concentrated, in fact almost limited, to water treatment. He thought that water treatment was the end and all of being, and that to be a good water treatment plant operator was the highest form of life. And I think perhaps had I been exposed only to Dr. Schoch's chemical engineering, I might have a somewhat different view of the chemical engineering profession. Later on, he got interested in making various products from natural gas by an electronic discharge method of some sort. I never understood it, and I'm not sure he did. And it worked more or less, but not real well, certainly not commercially. But that was a later phase of his career. But I was lucky enough that I was in the first class of a man that they brought into the department as the first real chemical engineering professor, a man named John Griswold, who was an recent MIT graduate and a very smart fellow, but very inarticulate. and he was not really cut out to be a public speaker or, from where I sat, a teacher. He was a terrible teacher. He would get up at the blackboard and turn his face to the blackboard and mumble and mumble, and if you really were interested in finding out what he said, you just had to listen like crazy and then ask a bunch of questions afterwards. But he knew what he was talking about, and he introduced us, me included, to chemical engineering as it really was, and I began then to realize that this is a pretty broad field, a lot broader than water treatment. So I think that had something to do with my going to MIT. I was inspired by what he obviously had learned being there. We went on to be good friends later on, and I had a high respect for him. He never really became an orator, far from it, but he did a good job as a chemical engineering professor.
I was just thinking that you said you wanted to emulate your father, and yet he was a chemist. You selected engineering as opposed to straight chemistry. Was there any reason for that?
Well, you're quite right. He took chemistry because that's all there was to take. But he specialized in industrial chemistry.
Okay.
And he was more of an industrial chemist and more of a chemical engineer than he was a chemist. I think he was a pretty good chemist, but he wasn't a research chemist. He wasn't a theoretical chemist, either physical or organic. He was more on the practical side. So it wasn't that much different from what his real career had been, even though it was in the very early days of the profession.
Did you get any practical experience in chemical engineering at UT? Were there any laboratories that were directed specifically to that?
Minimal. In fact, I can't remember a single laboratory that I would call a chemical engineering laboratory. That was a new field for the University of Texas, and they were just getting into it. So no, there was not that sort of a facility. I didn't really get into the practical laboratory part of it until the practice school at MIT, which we'll come to a little later, which was a very important part of my educational background. So, I can't think of anything else that we really ought to mention on at the university level.
How many students were in that chemical engineering program? A small number.
Total, all four classes was about 100, 120, something like that. And in the individual class, maybe 20. And we were fairly low on the engineering college totem pole. I mean, there were the civil engineers and the mechanicals, and to some extent the petroleum engineers were the glamour boys at that particular time. Of course, the electricals. But chemical engineering came into its own. I was fortunate enough to be in it during its days of glory, I think, really. It's heyday, its golden age. So,
had you sort of indicated why you went to MIT because of the Griswold, that connection? Had
part,
you thought
part
about
of
any other place, or was MIT the only choice you had?
MIT is the only one I seriously considered. I did apply at Caltech and was offered a fellowship there, but I elected to go to MIT. And I don't believe, I can't remember now, that I went through the application process in any other university, because those were the two outstanding ones, and I wanted to go to the best if I could. The Tulip Data Pi Fellowship gave me the opportunity to go anywhere I wanted to, and so I was able to, and probably would have opened the door any place I had applied. But those were the two that I, by whatever means, had determine were the two I wanted to consider.
Had you ever done much traveling before this, or was going to Cambridge your first time out of Texas?
Not quite the first time, but darn close to it. The family had taken a trip to the World's Fair. The Century of Progress, was it, in 1939, I believe it, whenever that was.
Well, it was earlier than that, but...
Somehow I think it was a little earlier, but nevertheless. We'd gone up to Chicago, and that was quite an expedition. And most of our travel, though, had been in Texas. Of course, that doesn't limit you too much. I mean, there's really a good many places to go in Texas. And we used to spend summers alternating vacations with my mother's sister's family, who lived in Uvalde, Texas, west of San Antonio. And they would come to Port Arthur for the summer one summer, and we'd go to Uvalde for the summer the next summer. And this went on for several years when my brother and sister and I were growing up. So we got to know the west part of Texas a bit by that association. But no, it was a new experience, and of course I've never been exposed to the Northeast. The family made it a family expedition to bring me up to MIT in the car, and we made a bit of a vacation trip, they did, and dropped me off at MIT and then drove back and left me dangling amongst all those Yankees trying to get along. And you know, it was a traumatic transition, as it would be for anybody making that move. And having been one of the smart boys in the chemical engineering class at the University of Texas, and having been valedictorian at high school and all that, I thought that was pretty hot stuff, as one tends to think in a case like that. But it wasn't too many days at MIT that I got my ears pinned back a time or two and realized that there were a lot of other smart people in the world who were actually a lot smarter than I was. And I had to really stir my stumps to keep up. I will never forget one of my first classes with Doc Lewis, W.K. Lewis. I was in his 1021 or whatever the course number was, general he used Walker Lewis McAdams as the textbook, and just general chemical engineering, basically unit processes is what I'm trying to think of. And I was on the question map and on the question mat. And I flubbed some question, and he gave a dumb answer. And boy, he just pinned me up on the blackboard and started throwing darts at me. And I said, Lord, no. I didn't know what to say. And I went home so humiliated that night, I just didn't know whether I was going to make it or not. But I realized later that the man had been right, and I'd been just as crazy as heck, and I tried to pull the wool over his eyes. That was a mistake of me, and I realized that later, that I tried to make Doc Lewis think that I knew something I didn't know, and boy, with him, you do that. And I soon learned that if you don't know, you say you don't know, and if you do know, you speak fairly crisply and stick to the subject at hand. Wonderful man, Doc Lewis. I mean, he was really one of the inspirations for chemical engineering, as far as I'm concerned, and for a lot of other people, too. I mean, he was Mr. Chemical Engineering, Dr. Chemical Engineering, and was the epitome of the most complete blend of real, solid scientific knowledge and practical application that I've ever known, and a great wit and a very effective teacher, sometimes a little brutal, but he would get the point over, no question about it. I was extremely lucky in that part of my career to have been at MIT at the time the Giants were there. And Doc Lewis was the chief among the Giants, but there was also Dr. McAdams, Mac, and Ed Gilliland, that I was closer to, and Walker, of course, had gone, but Lewis was still there. And Hoyt Hoddle, as we talked about earlier, was one of the big guys and was a great source of inspiration to me personally and was very kind to me. Later on, I became very close with Harold Weaver, whose specialty was thermodynamics, and he became my thesis professor later on, as it turned out. And we were very close friends, and I had a very, very high regard for Harold. And Tom Sherwood was there at the same time, and there are other names, but those are the ones that come to mind first. And they were all more or less pioneers in the profession, and certainly men of great stature in the profession, and highly regarded, and had a great regard for the profession as a profession, and recognized that it had a standing at least equal to the other engineering disciplines, and behaved themselves accordingly, both academically and professionally and personally. They were a fine bunch of people, and I just will never be grateful enough for the exposure to them. I somehow managed to get through the coursework, not with a great deal of distinction, although I got through everything and made reasonably good grades, but I was a long way from being the smartest guy in our class, and I knew it at the time, and I still know it. But I worked pretty hard, and it turned out all right. My big break came when I was selected or elected to go to the practice group. And that, I think, was the big eye-opener for me, as it has been for a lot of people who've gone through the practice school. I don't know whether you're familiar with the practice school or not, but it was an educational experience that I value extremely highly, as do most of the other people who've gone through. It was a unique arrangement in that we were sent out in small groups of 12 to 20 to live for 2 or 3 months at each of, at that time, 3 practice school stations. I was at the Bethlehem Works in Lackawanna, New York, and the Hercules Powder Plant in Parlin, New Jersey, and the Great Eastern and the Eastern Manufacturing Department, I think it was called, a paper mill in Bangor, Maine, for my 3 stations. And we served for those 2 or 3 months as a technical team for that company, and worked on technical problems that they had, and hopefully in some cases came out with constructive solutions to a problem. But in any event, whether we came out with a good solution or not, we learned a great deal about what the problems are and how to go about it and how to work together and how to explain it to your boss when you're finished, and in other words, to apply what we've been learning in the classroom for 3 years. And that was a eye-opening experience that, without any question, had a great deal to do with my continuing dedication to chemical engineering as a way to make a living.
So the companies actually gave you real problems to work on.
Yes, that was one of the keys to it. Each station had a director who was a full-time, at least assistant professor, maybe associate professor at MIT on the faculty. And he had an assistant also on the faculty at a lower level. But those two guys, together with appointed representatives of the companies, would work out a program of problems, of technical assignments that needed to be done. I mean, there were real problems. And, well, for example, one I remember in particular was running a heat and weight balance on a blast furnace in the Lackawanna plant and measuring the inflows and outflows, both in quantities and temperatures and analyses and so forth, and somehow making, as it turned out, a pretty darn rough heat balance, but at least we knew approximately where the big heat losses were and the big heat consumers. And a weight balance that showed more or less where the stuff went. And it was an eye-opener. I mean, it taught me what the steel business was all about, that part of it. And also taught me how to get along with the guys in the open hearth floor that had to shovel those buckets of dolomite or whatever into the open hearth furnace from time to time. It was a wonderful learning experience in many ways. In addition, in each station, to learning to get along with your fellow inmates, as it were, your fellow members of the team, and your landlady, and they varied from good to bad, and the new community and all that. It was a wonderful growing up experience. I came back then and did a thesis under Harold Weaver. It'll never shake the world, and I'm sure that it was one of the thinnest theses, both volume-wise and substance-wise, that's ever been turned into MIT. It was on, of all things, the catalytic decomposition of normal heptane in the presence of a nickel catalyst. Now, if you ask me how I got into that or why I was intrigued by this as a subject for chemical engineering research, I'm going to have to draw a blank because, frankly, to this day, I don't know. I guess I was attracted to it because at that time, catalytic cracking was just beginning to raise its head. And, of course, with Dad's background in aluminum chloride, that was catalytic cracking in a sense. Also, reagent cracking, but also catalytic to some degree. And I said, well, now this is a great field. Maybe if I know that nickel is an active catalyst for a lot of things, and if I could find the trick to putting that energy to work, as it were, in a constructive way instead of just blowing everything it touches to smithereens in the hydrocarbon area, then maybe we'll have something. So the idea was to somehow find a tag that you could hang on to that would give a clue as to how nickel's catalytic effect might be directed into more useful purposes than carbon and hydrogen. The net upshot of it was that we turned up no such clues, and demonstrated once again that nickel's effect on most hydrocarbons, on at least certainly on normal heptane, which we use just for analytical convenience purposes, was to blow it to smithereens, to carbon and hydrogen, period. And therefore we didn't contribute a great deal to the knowledge of the world, except that one more thing that didn't work.
Did you select that, or did you devise that problem, or did Weaver?
Yes, I did, and I have sometimes regretted that I didn't go around to the various professors and say, what have you got that you're interested in that I might be interested in. But what I did really was to dream up the problem and went around to find a professor who would sponsor me. And Harold had an interest in the Universal Oil Products Company and an interest in catalytic cracking in its incipiency, and he was intrigued by the possibilities. And so, yes, he took it on. But the burden really was on me to try to plow the ground rather than just relying on the professor to do the thinking and I do the work, which has its pluses and minuses. I mean, I don't regret that part of it at all, because I was a little bit on my own than some of my thesis brothers who simply were filling nooks and crannies for their professor's pet project. And they got something out of that I didn't have, but I got something out of mine that they didn't have. So somehow or another, I got through the doctoral exams. Don't know how. I think I'm digressing now. Another of the giants that I should have mentioned earlier was Walt Whitman, who was chairman of the department during at least part of the time that I was there. And thinking of my thesis reminds me of him particularly, because I think he was perhaps one of my proponents in my thesis exam. He was a good deal kinder to me than some of the others. At least I thought so at the time. But he was a nice man. Basically, he was just a very gentle, genuine gentleman. But I think he somehow took my side, maybe a little more than he had to, and I will always be grateful to him for that.